Welcome to the Presentation Podcast, episode 94. And now, another design studio conversation about presentation design and the business of running a design studio. Here are the show hosts, Troy Collar, Nolan Hames, and Sandra Johnson.
Hi, I'm Troy Collar from TLC Creative Services, Inc., based in Southern California.
Welcome to the Presentation Podcast. I'm Sandy Johnson with Presentation Wiz in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And I'm Nolan Hames from Nolan Hames Creative in Montclair, New Jersey.
Okay, today we are joined by a presentation industry luminary, Cliff Atkinson. Cliff, thanks for joining us. Cliff is author of Beyond Bullets, which is now in its fourth edition. We have a great discussion prepared for today, and it's going to cover a lot of ground, from talking about the book. We're going to talk about cultural resistance to better PowerPoint. We're going to talk about Cliff's amazing year of world travel that he's got going on right now, and the idea of giving back. So this is a great episode. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be with you guys. And I'm actually new to the whole podcast world. So I listened to one of your earlier podcasts, and I just love the connection and the community and the personality. So I'm really excited to be here today.
Is this the first time you've been a guest on a podcast?
It, as far as I remember, I don't know, maybe a zillion years ago I was on one.
Wow.
So I'm curious,
we are honored.
You guys too. Like, is it a new thing? Like, you know, I know podcasts have been around a long time, but as I've kind of been exploring the whole space, it seems like, you know, a lot of these information marketers and a lot of folks are now doing more podcasts. So do you think is it something that's kind of increased in popularity, or do you think it's the same?
And oh, yeah.
Some people are doing it more,
I think so.
Or what do you think?
I think it's exploded.
And why is that? Because I know for me too, like as a, you know, I don't have a commute, I guess is kind of an issue for me. So if I had a commute of an hour every day, or if I had long drives, then it would be something that I could, you know, just plug in and listen into one. But, you know, I work on the road and so on. So I'm just curious about that. Like, what attracted you guys? I don't want to flip the tables and be the interviewer, but I'm just curious about the whole podcast world.
It's got to be people that commute and have. Yeah. I know a lot of people that are. I'll just say they have a desk position where they are able to put in, you know, listen to the podcast, or you know, put in headphones and listen to it while they're actually doing their work. I don't commute either. I mean, my commute is, you know, we bought an office building less than 10 minutes from the house, but I am on airplanes all the time. So I'm either reading a magazine or listening to a podcast. So that's my biggest listening times, or when I'm driving to the airport.
Well, I was going to say, it's the sheer volume of options out there. It's easy to find an interest area. Mine happened to be philosophy and true crime and presentation.
But, yeah, I think we all have, I think it'd be very interesting to see everyone's sort of podcast list. But for me, I don't have a commute either, but I'm always doing things around the house, always running up and down and going places. And with my Apple AirPods, I can just have it in my pocket, throw it in my ear, listen to 5 minutes, 10 minutes while I'm taking the garbage out, come back and sort of pick up later. So it's, I don't know, I guess.
How far away is your garbage can that you have to take 10 minutes? Oh, wait, it's ice storms right now. It takes that long to walk carefully through the ice.
I was being relatively new to the whole space. It's just like, we're just listening to that one call, you know, the one podcast with you guys. It's like, wow, I really know you guys a lot better than I ever have before. It's just an intimate medium.
I wish I remember who it was, but a listener, and sorry for not remembering who you were, commented that they really like the podcast, and they're amazed each week that we're able to talk about something so visual, in just a, you know, just with an audio world. Am I making words up?
Mm-hmm. That was a big consideration. It's like, we talk about presentation? And the rationale for me was, I sit around and talk with other presentation designers all the time. We don't have our computers in front of us. So I, you know, contacted Nolan Sandy. I'm like, let's give this a go. And we're 2020 is now our fifth season. So we're in our fifth year.
How many episodes?
That's crazy.
Which episode is this?
This is 94 to a month. So yeah, so we're in season. This is the very beginning of season five.
Anything special?
And what are we ranked special in design?
For number 100? Anything special planned that's coming up?
You know, we actually, it's kind of funny, talked about it in the last one. I've actually been theorizing, guys, some ideas here. We're not going to do anything too crazy, but I think we should. So to Sandy's point, I get these reports, actually, you know, everything's analytics, and I don't, you know, we're a nonprofit as far as this goes. This is a passion project. We're not getting any revenue. So I don't pay for tons of the analytics, but the one I do get kind of lists us, and it's kind of funny. It lists where you're ranked every week as far as number of downloads. And I think that it's like 99% the Apple podcast, the iTunes downloads, what's measuring. It's not looking at us. We're on, I did invest some time. We're on Spotify. We're on SoundCloud. We're on Google. What's the Google one? Google Play. So we're everywhere, but it's kind of funny. So what they do to limit it, because I'm not paying the big bucks, they give me like a snapshot of six regions in the world where we rank. So one week it'll tell me how we ranked in France, and the next week it'll tell me how we ranked in the Netherlands. And it's like every third week I get a ranking of where we are in the US, which is kind of the bulk or the largest statistic. And in arts and design, unfortunately, it's a very big category that we don't really fit into a smaller niche category beyond that. We're closing in on the top 50. Sandy, I sent that email out.
58, I think it is.
We're at 58.
Congratulations.
Okay.
It includes arts as well. I thought it was just design. So arts even.
It's design.
Said even more.
Well, it's in art/design. So it's art is the category. Design is a subset within it, and it gets a little more tangled. So, anyways, we're doing pretty good. I mean, you know, it's kind of fun. I mean, I think longevity, like a web page or website, longevity plays a lot into it now. We'll see. Well, hey, should we talk more about conversations with Cliff? Sandy, why don't you start us off with something to talk about?
Sure. So we've all known each other, you know, whether at a distance or a little more closely for many years, but we were all able to reconnect at this year's presentation summit, where all three of us, we've spoken about this. I don't know if you listened to that podcast, Cliff, but it was an awesome keynote. It was the best I've heard. And so thank you for doing that, where you really focused on the value of visual storytelling. Mm-hmm. And we are going to talk about that. But I reheard the story about how your book led to your role in the Vioxx case. And I was wondering if you wouldn't repeat that for our listeners. I think it's an incredible story about the power of presentation. And you brought that to life in a court case. Huge court
Well,
case.
Sure. Do you want the long story or the short story?
Well, we heard the keynote, and it was a little bit longer than our entire episode. So the summary of how you got involved, what your rationale to the attorney's Mark.
Lanier, that's right.
Lanier? Yep. Lanier?
Well, yes.
Lanier.
Yeah, that's right. And I do want to tell, let me tell a little bit of the backstory too, because there's, especially because the folks that we're connecting with today as well, that, I talked a little bit, the backstory to this story was about PowerPoint, in that I shared, I'd always been interested, my background is English and journalism, and which was really about storytelling, writing a headline, getting to the point, telling the story of what happened. And so I was in the Air Force after college and was a public affairs officer. And I shared some of the things during my keynote. I actually found my overhead transparencies that I created when I was in the Air Force. And interesting, in the contrast, I guess that's been a theme, is the contrast of doing this live sketch on a transparency in an Air Force setting was surprising and memorable, because everything is so culturally staid and conservative and so on in that culture. And for somebody just to pull up, a transparency and draw this moose is, was memorable. But that's something that's been a theme throughout the whole thing. So as I'll tell more about that Vioxx story, but in the story, we did something really surprising. We talked about CSI and how you're like CSI detectives as jury members. And, doing surprising things visually, has been a big theme. How can you be, even before PowerPoint, and I guess that's a big part of this is, is it's not just about PowerPoint or presentations and so on in the technology part of it, but how are you using these tools, whatever they are, to surprise, to delight, to, you know, have your audience lean forward. You know, those are all pieces of it. But I do want to say that, so just the snapshot story is, so Air Force, I was doing these sketches, then I left the Air Force, I went to business school in London, did my very first PowerPoint presentation in 1996. So I found those slides too, where I was doing this report on entertainment industry economics, and it was all bullet points. So I did that, so it was just all bullet points, but then I came back to San Francisco, and then I wanted to create this video of what life was like in that dot-com boom. This was in the late 90s. And so I didn't know any video editing software. So I went in and figured I could use PowerPoint, and I went online and I found these animated GIFs and then used them. You know, what I did was open up PowerPoint, and then I realized that, you know, if you put a bunch of blank slides up and look in slide sorter view, that this is a storyboard and you can tell a story across all of these frames. It doesn't have to be text like I had done in my business school presentation. So that really opened up to me. That was a pivotal moment because, hey, this is actually a visual storyboarding tool and anything could go on here, you know? And so I created this video. It was like a 5 or 10 minute video with this house music track, and it was like this funny kind of, you know, having fun with these little animated GIFs. Like, I remember there was a Mariah Carey GIF on it saying, so for me, that was a big aha moment that relates to this whole arc of the story that, you know, I want to share. It's just that, you know, it's just how I looked at the tool and had a different view of it. You know, so I was starting, you know, from that first moment, I looked at it in slide sorter view with, you know, 20 blank slides. This is a visual storytelling tool, and this is like a film, not like a textbook. And that was, to me, the big insight, the aha moment. Like, this is not like the model, you know, with the evolution and creation of PowerPoint. You know, open it up, you know, it was type in your text. That's the default, you know, the very first line. It encourages the way it's set up. It mm-hmm. actually asks you, invites you to do that, you know. And how influential is that? Is like the very first one that opens up, and then you start typing. And so for me, if there was any big one little shift, you know, that would change the PowerPoint world, is like you open up in slide sorter view with 20 slides that are blank and say, what's the story here? What's the beginning, middle, and end? And so so I had that big aha moment. It's like, wow, you know, I created this video. And then, of course, nobody paid me to make any money off of it. And so I went back, you know, working for some .com. But then, you know, began, like, in this one .com, I created this visual business plan. I, like, was using PowerPoint more as a visual prototyping tool with no text. So that was the key for me. Is like, I would start out with a completely blank slide, just like, you know, you might win in video editing software or something. There's no text on it. So now I'm thinking visually. And so I created this visual business plan and, you know, this book, like, actually, you know, this printout of this book that was built in PowerPoint, but it looked like, you know, you'd done it in Illustrator, or not Illustrator, but InDesign or something. It's like, it was actual document, but it was all very, very visual. And so, so of course, you know, that .com closed with the .com bust. And then, you know, I still was, you know, like, I had something creative to say. And so I, you know, wanted to do visual stuff and visual storytelling. And so I ended up doing freelance, like, PowerPoint design work. And then with that, you know, I was like going to all these companies and saying, hey, you know, you could tell a visual story. And, but was still doing this temp sort of work. And then I started realizing, oh, hey, you know, I think importantly, I was coming from a frame of reference, like I'd gone to business school. So I was looking at this, I don't have a design background at all. So I didn't come through the design track, graphic design or visual track. I was coming through more, you know, just going to business school. And then I just had like this way of looking at things that was visual. And so I wanted to go out on my own, but of course there was no business model for doing this sort of thing. So just doing that temp work. But then I started, as I realized, you know, I need to talk about this. And so I started writing these articles for a free website called Marketing Profs. And the headlines of those articles, I think, were something like, you know, bullet points kill effective communication, or, you know, and with it.
So did you come up with that line?
Yeah. Well, I had
Death by PowerPoint,
like,
was that
2003? I don't know if there was any for 2003.
Probably.
But I was writing these articles, you know, and then a big key with these, the theme of these, it was like, you know, you can tell a story with this tool. Another part was about the content. It's like, you know, the headline, next headline was, you know, it should be like from all about us to all about them. And to me, that's the thing you still see today, like when corporate capabilities, like here I am and here's all how great I am, et cetera, from the start, you know, and people say, well, I have to do this. It's like, well, why do you have to do that? Why can't you just start with the audience and look at what their needs are and then shape it around them, right? And so, and then you know, it's related, you know, now we're going to hopefully talk about cultures, but then, you know, these cultures, you know, coalesce around, well, we have to have a corporate capabilities presentation and we must do this when people walk in. It's like, well, why are you doing, I'm the guy to come in, like, why are you boring people talking about you? Why don't you talk about them from the very start? The same underlying issues, but, you know, that's where they're there and they're still, still often there now, you know, like talk about them, like ask them a question and then tailor it to what their needs are. Well, so then I was writing the article, no business, you know, I'm just doing temp work, et cetera, you know, but for me, you know, I was writing it from this perspective that, you know, and it was more a strategic perspective. It's like, well, you know, why are you as a company doing this? So this is really, I would say I was directing this, having come from business school, to the C-suite, you know, to the leadership of the organization. Like, why are you allowing this to happen in your organization? You know, why are you allowing these corporate capabilities presentations that shut down your conversation with your customer and are impacting your business, you know? So it was really at that sort of strategic level I was kind of addressing these, but I didn't have any specific audience and no clients. And so I remember sitting in my, you know, in my bedroom office in 2000, I think it was 2003. And I get a phone call and, you know, again, I have no clients, just doing temp work. And then a guy calls and he said, hey, this is, my name is this Cliff? Yes. I said, hey, Cliff, my name is David. You might have heard of my company. It's called General Electric. And I work for the board of directors. And we as a company have decided to make all of our communications clear and simple. And so we did that with this new branding campaign called Imagination at Work. And it went great everywhere except for our boardroom PowerPoint presentations. Like, those are still the worst thing. You know, we can't solve that problem. Make these clear and simple. We've been reading your articles. Can you help us? And I said, well, sure. That was my first client as a consultant, was the board of directors of General Electric, to help them to tell, you know, so they were asking me, you know, the problem they faced at the time is, you know, it's these big organizations like that, especially the board level, are facing, you know, PowerPoints then and many still today, you know, they're just like jam-packed of full of information. They had decks of 20 slides. And so their solution was to say, okay, we're going to do 3-slide limit. And of course, what happens? You know, you take what's in 20 slides and squeeze it down into, you know, 3 slides. And it's like, oh, well, that's too complicated. You get 1 slide. Of course, what happens? You know, you get, what's the smallest, do you guys know what's the smallest font size you can actually, you can use in PowerPoint? Like 3? Okay.
I think it's 1.
They use 1 point.
It's
1 point font.
Or you get the layers of animation. Oh my God. So it's just 5 slides. Done in 5
all that
layers
stuff
on
in there
one slide.
At these board level presentations, and I'm going, you guys are making strategic decisions for the company based on these, you know, these PowerPoints. And so then, you know, I did a little audit of their presentations and then created this storytelling guide. You know, this is how, you know, and with that, you know, what are your 3 main points? You know, what do you want to, you know, it was really distilling down the core elements of storytelling. So I created this little training program for them. And then I think I was talking about that, you know, in the story at the first presentation summit, the PowerPoint Live back then. I think that was 2003 or 4.
That's when we met.
I was talking with Rick Brettschneider about it. Like, what
year was that?
I think it was. Was it in 2003 or 4?
I would have to look back. I will look it up.
Okay.
Just for reference, hold on. One. Just for reference, Sandy is correct. You can use 1 point text in PowerPoint.
Yes.
But I'm in Calibri and I'm zoomed in the maximum and I still can't read the word.
I love it.
You said three slides at GE. I think the trend today is five slides. That's what I hear a lot. Maximum five slides. That's what people are saying. So, and then of course they shove an hour of content onto that.
Well, and then with that too, I mean, then you get in the whole frame of reference. Is it a slidument? You know, is this actually a print document, a handout that you're showing me, or is it actually a, are we going to make a decision together about where to lead the company? You know, those are two different ways you can use the tool. So I don't remember. I think with Rick Altman, then I don't know. I'll have to ask him too. Our original connection. I don't know if it maybe was through ICIA or Infocom or that whole thing that was happening there. But he invited me to speak there and at the first conference, and I talked about, you know, this story with GE, and then Rick Bretschneider was there from Microsoft. He said, "Hey, I know that Microsoft Press wants somebody to write a book about, you know, different ways to use the tool." You know, the pitch, it was interesting at the time, was like, you know, everybody, this was 2004. So the pitch was, you know, from the Microsoft side, Microsoft Press, it's like, okay, well, everybody has the software. Everybody knows how to do the basics. How about if we invite some people to do something, you know, different? Like, what's a different way to use this tool other than just learning the features and so on? Right. So they're looking for somebody to write a book in PowerPoint. So Rick introduced me, and then I talked to them, and then we agreed on a book contract. So then that became the book that came in March 2005 was the first edition. It had an orange cover. And then now I'm looping around to answer Sandy's original question. So the book I'd written was for a business audience, like how can you tell a visual story? And the book came out in March. And then a couple months later, this lawyer named Mark Lanier found a copy of the book. So it was just hot off the presses. He had a really big case coming up. This is for this painkiller called Vioxx. It turned out that the company had been, you know, selling the pill, but they had had studies that showed that it increased the risk of heart attacks, but they didn't tell the public about it. There's lots of documentation about all this where they, you know, of course, if they release information like that, then people are going to stop buying the drugs. So they have a financial interest to not let that information out. So in this case, then, this woman named Carol Ernst, her husband had died of a heart attack, and she took it upon herself. She's like, well, he's too young to die like this. Like, what could have led to his death? And she looked at what he took. She saw he took Vioxx and did her own research and said, oh, well, she connected the dots and said, hey, it was probably Vioxx that was a cause of his heart attack because of the studies and his research, you know, that she made those connections. And then, so Mark took on that case, and that case was going to come to trial in July of 2005. And so his story is that, you know, he had been using PowerPoint. I didn't even know, you know, people use PowerPoint in trial. This is 2005. I didn't know that was even a thing that happened. And so the story is that he had been using it. He's based out of Houston in Texas, and also teaches Sunday school. So he'd been using PowerPoint in Sunday school. And he says that every big trial, he likes to take some skill set to the next level to challenge himself and to keep learning. And so that particular trial, it was PowerPoint. And so the story he tells is that, you know, he was he went off to Greece before the trial, you know, a couple months before the trial to kind of just chill out and relax, but had brought a stack of books on PowerPoint. And so the story he tells is that, you know, he'd read the first book and it was just about, you know, well, this is how you use the features. And you know, the joke is he tossed it over the side, and then he read the next one. It was just like, how do you make more bullet points? How do you make your bullet points prettier? And he tossed it over the side. But then the story is like, he got to my book and I was talking about different things. I was talking about storytelling structure, and strategy and visuals and structure and all those sort of stuff. And then he like found the book, and then he like called back, you know, to his office in Houston to his assistant Dara and said, Dara, like, see if you can get Cliff, you know, to help us with this opening statement. And so I got that call from his assistant, you know, and she said, you know, hey, this is Dara. Would you, you know, do you have any connections? She said the first question, do you have any connections with the pharmaceutical manufacturer? And I said, no. Why? Like, I don't know. Like, why is that important? And she said, well, you know, have you ever worked on a legal case? And I was like, no, I have absolutely, you know, do you guys use PowerPoint? I didn't know you use PowerPoint. What are you talking about? she said, well, this guy, you know, my boss, Mark, has this big case coming up, and he read your book, and he liked what you had to say about story and storytelling and structure and visuals. You know, would you be willing to come out and work with us to create the opening statement for the first day of trial? And my first response was, well, what's an opening statement? You know, like, what is that? And it turns out, like, the first day of these cases, the two lawyers from each side, the plaintiffs and the defense, they stand up and present their story to the jurors. So they have usually, these days, they're about 45 minutes to an hour. And so it's these dueling stories. So the plaintiff goes first, usually, and they stand up and they present their case. Here's how the defendant was a bad guy and what they did and how they hurt this person and you know, how they're responsible for that. And then the defense goes up and say, well, no, you know, that's not the case. And then they rebut what they said and present their story. But by and large, most lawyers agree or have a consensus that after the jurors hear those two presentations the first day of trial, that they decide which way they're gonna go. They have already decided that first day with that initial impression, you know, if they're going to be for the plaintiff or the defense. And so because that's such an important, you know, decision and has so much weight and so high stakes, you know, lawyers now are, well, starting in 2005 with Mark and others, you know, a lot of, since then, put a lot of investment into the presentation that first day of trial, because it's so, they think it's so important that you get that story right. And so, so I flew out, I worked, you know, found out what an opening statement was, and then flew out, and then we just jumped right in and used the method that I kind of laid out in the book. And the gist of it is that you come up, you know, your three most important ideas you want the jurors to remember when they walk out after you're done. And then it's a logic tree structure. So this is, you know, a big influence by somebody named Barbara Minto. Have you guys heard of this person, Barbara Minto?
Yeah. Is that the pyramid principle? Is that her?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I learned about her, I think, in business school. And it's basically, it's the thinking, the process, the critical thinking process that people at these management consulting firms like McKinsey and Deloitte and all these big firms teach this, and that's where she teaches. So she teaches the smartest of the smartest folks how to think in a logical structure. And basically it's a logic tree structure where you come up with your three most important things and you back that up and then you back that up. You know, so it's like, you know, three levels of, at its essence, three levels or more of information. But you're distilling down information to its essence so that you can make decisions based on that the way that you think. And so, you know, I kind of embedded that into the structure because I thought that was so important, you know, like that's a critical challenge, I think, for any presentation. How do you distill this down to its essence? And there's different, you know, of course, there's different types of presentations. There's a keynote presentation, which are more about the big emotions, the big takeaway, you know, a lot of entertainment value. You're just wanting people, you know, they tend to be more aspirational and more, you know, and more entertaining versus this category of presentation, which is still the norm in organizations and corporations and the executive levels. You know, how can this tool help with my critical thinking, with my decision making? How do we make a decision for this organization? You know, different types of presentations. But with this one, it's a, you know, critical thinking issue and decision making presentation. And so then I applied that to this legal trial because this is what the jurors have to do. You know, this is not a entertaining. Well, you know, certainly entertainment and getting people engaged and getting them to lean forward is across the board any type of communication. But in this specific type of communication, you know, jurors are need to learn the evidence, you know. So this is, you've got a bucket of information that's been approved by the judge that is evidence, and then you've got to look at that evidence and then weigh that evidence based on what decision you have to make, and then you make your decision. So with that, it's more of a left brain, a sort of analytical sort of process. So then for the lawyer side, they will often, like in that BIOS case, Mark had 6 million documents. You know,
wait, what do you mean 6 million documents? This I've never heard.
So this is all like, so in that case, yeah. So in that case, so in that Biox case, you know, the bucket of evidence that's admitted is all the clinical trials. It's all the emails from the company to each other saying, you know, don't, you know, squash that information. Don't get it out. Or it could be, you know, also the science, you know, your expert reports that are describing, well, how is it that the drug
so
works?
There is like when I've never heard that statement. That's amazing.
Yes. You know, so there's so much in there. It's, but, you know, and you've got to teach, you know, like in a case like this, you've got to teach the jurors, how does this work? What happens when you take the pill? Like, what is it? How does it impact your bloodstream? Like, what is it? How does it end up, you know, impacting your heart? You know, there's like, you know, so much information that you've got to somehow distill down, tell a story, and you know, subtly and implicitly, you know, you're presenting your point of view with this. So, and so in, embedded into it, it's there's a persuasive structure. You know, you
so to jump ahead, the case was won by Mark, and he attributes a lot of the success to his opening presentation, right? Not even during the case. It was like the opening. Isn't that the one that?
That's right. And then the metric for that was they actually went back and interviewed the jurors 6 months later so they could do that. And they remembered the opening statement. So they remembered the three things.
Isn't that
so
something?
Did we cover the price tag on
well,
this?
Well, just
the,
give your statement the, about the price, per, paid, price per slide the, is what was the biggest impact thing around.
So the big verdict was just $253 million, which, you know, at the time was a really big verdict. And then I ended up...
It's a lot of money.
Wasn't it the largest at the time?
There had been bigger ones, like with those big
tobacco lawsuits. Okay, irrelevant. It's $253 million.
It's still not bad. It's not bad.
So what is that for a slide? Because I know you broke this down.
Well, and so I did. I went back and, you know, so after the whole trial, I went back and again, you know, this goes back to the whole thing we're talking about too, is like, you know, when the number of the five slides or whatever. So like if you're looking at this PowerPoint like a film strip, and then you're animating across slides, you're doing interesting things, you know, it's the number is not, you know, in terms of like restricting slides to numbers, you can do that for slideuments, but it's not really relevant if you're creating a film. Like how many frames was the Godfather movie, you know, or the Frozen movie? How many frames was it? Is it irrelevant? So, but I did count up, you know, for mine. So I counted up the number of slides I used for opening and then for closing. So it was like 153 slides for opening and 100 for closing. So it's 253 slides exactly. So $1 million a slide.
That's a good return on investment there, because I know
that was pretty good. That's right.
Let me go with this one then, Cliff, because the book Beyond Bullets, Cliff's book that we're talking about, is key to anyone who wishes to like increase the value of what they do in presentation and PowerPoint. I really, really, truly say that I'll actually go so far as to say it's one of the original presentation industry books on my shelves. I don't know if I have anything that predates it I definitely don't have anything that predates it that's still on my bookshelf. I purchased the first edition. Largely based on us, I largely bought it, not even knowing what it was, based on our conversation, us meeting back at that very first PowerPoint Live. It's like, oh, this guy's got a book.
Wow.
I should buy this. It's still a book on my bookshelf, and I reference it today.
And it's in its fifth printing or fifth, fourth edition.
Fourth edition just came out last year. Finally, they gave me color after all those three editions. Everything was... It's so frustrating, right? You're talking about visuals and then it's all in black and white. So finally got color.
Yeah, I was noticing that when I was flipping through it last night. It, my version is still, because I don't have the fourth edition.
Finally.
Okay, so I do have a question, or I do have a question. So we hear a lot about storytelling, and Beyond Bullet Points provides what I'll say is a solid, easy to implement technique that gives guidance on storytelling structure. I mean, it's one of the first books out there, not on how to create a story or a structure of a story, but it's the first one that said, here's a way to do story structure in presentation. So the overall process, I don't really think it's changed much across the four editions of the book. I don't think the book has changed dramatically, has it? As far as its like approach and philosophy?
No. So the core approach philosophy has stayed the same. And I've tweaked and fine tuned some stuff and based on people's feedback and so on, you know, I've gotten, but the core, what I would say the core the what I call the intellectual engine behind the hood is that distillation process. And again, this is the type of, and I think now maybe in retrospect over the years, you know, I've kind of seen there's like this sorting out of, there's been this huge flourishing of a lot of great books and materials about creating slides and for more of a keynote or a TED talk, that sort of thing, where things are very, very simple and visual and so on. And it's more this aspirational message. So this book from the beginning has been more about that critical thinking process. When you've got the 6 million documents and you've got to distill it down to 3 points, what do you do? This process helps you to do that. So it's more for that other category of presentations where you're making presentations for decision making. And especially, you know, for critical thinking, when you've got to take something complex and get it down to its essence. So it's really that category of presentations where I think it's probably most applicable and helpful.
So if the core, what's the word I want to use here? So if the core ideology of this, or if this core methodology of creating a story hasn't changed much, would, and this is kind of an open question for everybody, and I'll give my opinion as well. Do we think the presentation design has actually evolved? Not the presenting part, but the actual, like there was an evolution in your book of, instead of saying, here, you should probably list a title and 7 bullet points on every slide. And that would have been a great thing if it was only 7 bullet points back then. but, you know, has presentation evolved, even though the core methodology, I mean, this is a great case study to say, listen, all the way back in 2004, a case study came out beyond bullet points of how to create a story for presentation. So does everybody feel that, and Cliff, we'll just start with you. Do you think that presentation itself has evolved as far as being able to support the story, or has evolved to better reflect story and conveying persuasiveness versus keynote hype and things like that?
That's a great question. You know, when I was thinking about this earlier too, before our call, that's almost like, we almost have to take a step back and say, like, you know, presentation, it's almost like this whole genre, let's say, take the whole category of writing. If we just say the word writing, and then within writing, you've got different genres. You've got novel writing, you've got, you know, nonfiction, you've got fiction, you've got personal narrative, you've got poetry, you've got headliner, you've got all these different genres of writing. And so maybe if we apply that model of presentations and say, okay, out of presentations, there's keynotes, there's decision-making presentations, there's, you know, there's like visual improv, there's like the, what's that, how do you pronounce, Pechakucha?
How
do you
say Pechakucha?
How do you say,
however you want to pronounce say that. It.
that thing in my bum. There's all these different genres. And then within those, you know, sometimes, you know, the core of underlying, just like in any communication, you know, you're wanting to tell some story, and that's going to be our most compelling and interesting way to connect with folks. And so I guess I would say that there's still the same, you know, pre-PowerPoint story was a very effective way to communicate. And then now with PowerPoint, you know, using that tool, it can now take it to the next level of visual storytelling and make it even greater impact. But even if PowerPoint were to go away, we're still going to be telling stories, we're still going to be connecting and so on. So I think that, you know, PowerPoint gives an interesting, like if you introduce that to, it's, you know, this is an ancient million years we've been telling stories. So now we've introduced the visual tool, and I think it helps to innovate it and do things that you could not otherwise do. And help to take things to a new level. So especially for in-person presentations, and that's been a big thing for me, is the unique ability of this tool to be able to unlock connection and communication through the use of a visual on a big screen. You know, so I've always kind of had the perspective on it that the true value of this is not the slideuments and not the handouts and so on, because you could use other tools for that. But if I can put up an image, like, so I mentioned, like, yeah, with the Biox one, you know, put up an image of just the CSI logo. And I said, you know, we said to the jurors, you get to be like CSI detectives and you get to figure out what happened to Bob, you know, so that visual and then the words, and then there was a whole strategy behind it where he was now taking, you know, what's called a product liability type of case, you know, to a conservative jury where you're not going to get a big verdict, and reframing it. And saying now it's like a murder mystery, you know, it's just like these popular TV shows, and you get to be a part of it, you know. So and then all that was on that slide was just the, you know, I just grabbed the logo off of, you know, off of a website, but but something happened there that was able to engage the jurors, make it so memorable. It was surprising context to say that. So that's just one example of how, like, you know, telling that story in that context with the visual makes it 100 times more interesting than otherwise.
So, you know, given that storytelling is so key in all areas, in business and in the courtroom, I just saw a couple of courtroom slides as part of an article I read. And I mean, it was as bad as you can imagine. And yet it was very clearly.
Can you send me that? Do you have a screen cap or something?
I wish I knew where it was. I just love to nerd out.
I'll try to find out where it was.
But it was something. I think it was a fairly simplistic or simple case, a kind of an open and shut case. But even what they were putting up was you know 30 years ago thinking and not. And anyway, so my question is, whether it's in the courtroom or whether it's in business, people recognize the importance of storytelling. It's the buzzword. It's all this and that. And yet there's still this huge resistance to even doing the modicum of work that is, you know, separate from the fun, you know, moving pixels around and stuff. This modicum of work that is the bulk of Beyond Bullet Points and where you start with it and what we've been talking about. Why is there resistance to that? Is it laziness? Is it ignorance? Is
fear?
It fear? I mean, what just even just the slightest?
Oh my God! Don't get us started on this whole topic. I mean, because there is something. I mean, that's what struck me from the very, very beginning. You know, when I'm looking at these slides from this big company, one of the biggest companies in the world, and you see these slides, and it's like, are you guys really making decisions? You know, $1 billion decisions on behalf of your company using this? Right. And like, why is that? Like, how is it that it came to be like this? And why, you know, so I really, you know, there's such entrenched cultures, you know, I've kind of thought about all this stuff. I haven't really written a lot about it because it's, you know, it's not part of like, you know, a method book or something like that. But, you know, the culture starts at management consultancy firms, and then they have a certain way of doing things. And so everybody does it that way. And then it just becomes an inherited culture and nobody questions it. And that's always struck me too. And I think maybe it's gotten better now, but you know, it struck me too at organizations like who's the decision maker when it comes to, okay, we're going to use PowerPoint this way, and we're going to use bullet points, or we're going to use just visuals, or however you're going to do it. Who actually holds the decision? And it's interesting that very often that there's nobody that holds it. It's just like, this is invisible. There's no man, or what's that, like in the Wizard of Oz or something, don't look behind the curtain. There's nobody there. Like, there's nobody that actually owns it. And that's the big thing I've had, like the CEO, you need to own this.
You nailed it.
And put a lot of thought into it and think about the whole thing. It's a strategic corporate decision. And this has always come up over the years. It's just like, well, what, you know, like I'm trying to make changes and I did it better. And then my boss says, no, do it the old way. Cause my boss won't like it. We do it certain ways. It's like, what are you guys doing that, you know, you're just squashing something that's effective because you think because the culture, but nobody's in charge of the culture. And it's just like this, what's going on here? It's just reflective of what might be some general patterns of dysfunction or inefficiencies at organizations.
Yeah, and I think for any of us who've worked for big companies, we are not surprised to tell other people, yeah, just because they're worth $1 billion doesn't mean they, you know, have the smartest people there. Doesn't mean they're doing it better. I mean, it's still an office of people.
Here's a big picture thought. This is perfect. So I'm looking at kind of the presentation evolution. Do you see more competition or more people providing that service, and has it evolved for you over the years?
Well, it's been a mix. It's a mix, I think. You know, so there are. So my whole take on the thing is that, and again, I kind of go back to this whole strategic perspective. It's like the C-level folks, they need to own this. They need to own the story strategy. They need to get, you know, before that, they need to learn the skills of storyboarding, story structure, you know, just sketching slides. And then at that point they partner, you know, along with the folks who are designing, then, you know, they, if the story is clear, distilled, the message is, you know, easy to understand, like any visual person would love to have it at that point and, you know, tackle that and work with it and make an amazing presentation. So there's still this mix, I guess. There's still like a, you know, so I do see some folks who are kind of taking on the whole story, the story structure, the distillation, and learning those skills, and then that just creates a better and better presentation. But then at the same time, there's still folks, and we just mentioned, we see them on airplanes, we see them all around, where it's just this, you know, 6 million documents in one PowerPoint, you know, they're, you know, point after point, you know. So I think it's a mix, but I think it's, you know, interesting time because there's a lot of good resources and people are learning and, you know, and seeing the results. So I can give that story that, you know, after Mark got his great results and he ran around and told all of his friends, you know, you gotta bring in this guy to do this. And now through word of mouth, you know, I've done tons of other legal projects since then. So it didn't exist before. He was an innovator to introduce it into his culture. But then through the results he got, you know, then all those other friends and people that he works with now do it as well. So maybe that's part of it too, is like with these, you know, stories and with, you know, best practice or case studies and so on, that those are things that help to move and things are moving, but it's a mix, you know, cause we straddle this divide between the strategy and then the graphic design, you know? So then there are folks who might just do purely graphic design, and then folks who do strategy, and then folks who do both.
I think there are, the civil litigation sort of world you've been talking about, it's a very clear reward that's sort of on the table, like either we get this or we don't. And I think that's similar in the business world to the high stakes pitch, you know, either we get the $100 million contract or we don't, or we get the, you know, $200,000 contract or we don't. And it rests on the deck. And a third case might be an investor pitch deck, right? Either we get the investment or we don't for our company. And I think those are probably, and I don't know too much about the sort of the world of litigation, but I think those are it's so black and white there, the value of presentation. And so maybe those are the places where people are spending the most time on that and really recognizing it, of, you know, of course, just, and so we should at least be thankful, I guess, that, you know, we have those case studies of people really, I guess, doing it right. I guess it's the day-to-day business slog where it's really absent.
Well, I do. Yeah, I have a couple things to say about that. I mean, one would be that would be I would issue the challenge to all of our community. Like, as we get better at quantifying the true value of these presentations, you're going to get paid more. Okay, because if you can go in and you can say, just like any of those decks, you know, we're talking big numbers, like even 10 million. I need $10 million investment. You tried to work with a company, a transportation company, and they had done, you know, all about me presentations that we've all seen. I intervened. I did this, you know, new approach, and then they won a huge verdict. And I mean, not a verdict, but they won the contract. And the folks who were involved say, well, this is the best presentation we've ever delivered. Like, we need to do more of these, those sort of things. So is if we can go in even after the fact and say, this intervention, you know, when I came in and involved, you know, we improved, you won this, you got this. And so, you know, even after the fact and say, like, what's the value? What was the value of my intervention? And they'll say, well, yeah. Well, let me give you a specific example. Oh, go ahead. I know.
I was going to ask everybody for examples of that, of quantifying. I mean, I think that's huge.
We got to get better. We got to get better at that. And let me just throw in a real quick recent story. So I helped this, you know, I just helped a lawyer friend, you know, just to spend 3 hours of my time. I charged, you know, just a minimal amount for him, is because I knew the guy. But he came to me afterwards and he said, like, so, you know, defense, so he's a plaintiff's attorney, and, you know, defense attorneys, so they have a big adversarial relationship, right? So the defense is never going to say good things to the plaintiffs afterwards. But he said, after I, you know, he settled his case, he got what he wanted, he said, afterwards, the defense attorney came to me and said, that was the best presentation I've seen in my career. And then number two, he said, he volunteered this. He said, your PowerPoint, I think your PowerPoint put $250,000 additional on the table than if you did not have it. Like, he specifically pointed out the PowerPoint and said that brought $250,000 in value. So that's great if he can start grabbing those numbers and saying, okay, so if my intervention Yeah, this is a point for professional self-reflection, right? So if you can, if you have examples like that, then you can say and talk to clients. So if I can increase this, put an additional $250,000 on the table, what percent of that is it worth to bring me on for the next project?
Yeah. How have you charged in the past? Do you charge hourly? Do you charge that project rate? Do you ever do a percentage of
that's always been the number one question. Like, what percentage did you get? Like, and if you're in the legal profession, you cannot charge legally. You can't. It's illegal to charge percentages unless you're a lawyer. Like, there's a whole thing around that.
Yeah, unless whole thing a lawyer, around that. Right.
So I've charged, project-based fees, but I know that that's undervalued. So it's an ongoing strategic question for me. It's just because I can't get those percentages like they get, but they're getting really big numbers. And then so what's a fair sort of way that we could work? And that's kind of what I'm working on now, actually. I'm actually creating this online training course.
Cliff, I want to thank you. We mentioned Jerry Wiseman earlier. Both of you are on the Guild's advisory board, and I just wanted to thank you in particular for what you've contributed, for being there, and also for what you've started on the Guild Slack channel or the Slack workspace. It's a give back channel, and you've connected us with some folks in the industry to maybe be able to give back our talents as presentationists. But let's talk a little bit more about your intentions.
I do want to say it's just so exciting to I really enjoyed hanging out with the Presentation Guild folks, in San Antonio, and it was just a wonderful community. I'm just so excited that the community has really kind of taken off, and you've got the certification and then the Slack channel and all the other stuff going on. So it's like really exciting to see all the energy and I was able to hang out with the community all week. So it was really fun to be with you guys. And I think that I was really inspired by the one other keynote, the German researcher who told the story about finding the straw in the turtle's nose. And it just launched this whole movement, about straws. And it was so interesting, the impact that that one little video, that one visual, the one story had. And so it just impacted me. It's like, well, wow, how can we give back? How can we help? There's so many folks who do have really good causes, and how can we as presentation professionals offer them, if they can't afford it or they're doing good work. And connected you guys with Andy Goodman, who is specializes in presentations for nonprofits, and he was going to connect and find some folks who might be looking for help with presentations. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a whole website around that
he wrote an article for us in his
newsletter. Awesome. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah,
oh, awesome.
So we were
okay,
featured
cool.
in that. Mm-hmm.
And he was a guest on the podcast.
So that was the intention behind it. Like, how can we, offer our help, because there's so many great causes in the world, and I think we can give back in some way as well.
To wrap up our conversation, I want to say thank you to Cliff for joining us. The world of professional presentation design, story, and presenting, it continues to evolve. And Cliff, you've been one of those forces that has propelled that evolution with making so many great concepts and just edifying the presentation process with the Beyond Bullets books and your ongoing consulting and contributions to so many things in our industry. For everyone that joined us for this conversation, it's been great. See you in a few weeks for another conversation about presentation design, the business presentation. But don't go far. We're going to come right back with Pro and Tech Tips.
Yeah, let me start. I'm going to recommend an article to read. It's what's the difference between Office 365 and Office 29? I'm sorry, 2019. The MVPs on this call are asking each other that all the time. What's the difference between? And for the regular user out there, I just think it's an insightful article. It helps you decide if you want either or. So we'll put a link in the show notes and check it out.
Is that a Microsoft or a freelance writer? Or where's that one published?
Hold on. Let me answer that question.
Well, is it on a Microsoft website or is it on another website?
It's on the Microsoft Office website.
Okay, well, I'll get the link from you and definitely put it in the show notes because I should probably... Oh, is that the one you put on Facebook recently?
I did put it on Facebook and I've pasted it for you in the show notes, so you've got it.
Cliff, do you have a pro or tech tip you could share with everybody while we got you here?
Oh my gosh, so I'm so excited about my new AirPods Pro. So I've never had AirPods. So I've always ever done the Bose noise canceling headset. And so I was
okay, that's what I've done. So this is so good.
I was at a party last week. This guy said, "Hey, have you checked these out?" And I said, "No, I don't like AirPods. I don't like those big white things sticking out of my ears." And he said it was worth every penny I spent. So I went, I tried them on. And I've not taken them out of my ears since in the last 2 weeks. So they're amazing. You put them in your ears and you cannot hear anything. And I think that may have a downside. I'll let you know if that happens. But you literally cannot hear anything. And the noise canceling is so good. So it's like you're suddenly, I put these things in and I'm just lost in another world. You know, so it really is great at the noise canceling. But then you turn on music and I'm just so absorbed in what I'm doing. It just really, especially noisy places like a Starbucks with all the really, you know, the blaring music and so on. You put these in and it just allows you just to be immersed in sound so that you can really focus on what you're doing. So
now, I have a dumb question.
I've got a question too. Hold on. This is pro tech tip for us. Sandy, what's yours?
Can it be used for non-Mac products?
Yes. So it's just Bluetooth enabled, so you can connect it to your laptop, listen to YouTube, you can do anything.
My Android phone. Yes.
It's Bluetooth.
Ooh, okay. Wow.
So you're the first person I've talked to. So and that said, actually, I love my Bose headsets. I have several pair. Actually, I have the earbuds, I have the over the ear. You know, I travel with them nonstop. And so it has the same idea. It's actually noise canceling technology, not just, hey, I've got a really good earplug.
Yes, because it's always been that Bose has been the state of the art. They're the only ones who've been able to figure this out, but now Apple has. And I had no. And also those little, the dumb sticks, the white sticks sticking out of your ear, they're like half the size. Even better, because I hate that thing.
What about.
Good questions about this
I'm so particular. Yes. What about the part that goes in your ear? They're usually a lot of
heads. Are they comfortable? Is that what you're asking?
Super comfortable.
Do they go into the ear canal?
They go in your canal and then they have three different size tips. So, and then you can run a little test on through your iPhone. It says, you know, test the fit.
Oh.
And it'll tell you if it can hear noise escaping. Huh. And then you might try a smaller or larger.
I love it.
It turned out that I'm the default size, so I didn't have to change it.
And these have got to be great for travel for you and just everything else.
Oh my God, just travel. I mean, because, you know, the downside of the Bose things are just the bulkiness of the size. And then also.
That's why I got the earbud ones.
And also when you're traveling. For the bulkiness. And then when you're traveling, you've got the big, you know, you wear them for 8 hours and it's got the big, you know. Got a big indentation in your head.
Yeah, your hairline is definitely not what it was.
But
that is
like
awesome.
I wear these. I've worn them like I wear them Starbucks. I wear them in the house. I wear them traveling. So it's just, you know, because they're so convenient. But now after, you know, I probably should get the Apple Care for these too, though, because they're going to be really easy to lose. I can tell because they're so small.
Oh, good thinking. Hey, question. You're just in Colombia. Is there Starbucks in Colombia? You know, because it's Colombian coffee. I could imagine the answer is no. But I mean, there's Starbucks all over Italy. So it kind of.
I don't remember seeing a Starbucks there. But yeah.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah.
Did you get coffee in Colombia?
Yeah, it's the home of Colombian coffee. And I want to go back. You know, I was just there for a couple of days. Medellin is spectacular.
Oh,
it's
really?
It's in a steep valley. And all the skyscrapers are built along the sides of the valley. I've never seen something like that. But yeah, I want to go back and it's so inexpensive. Stayed at a 5-star hotel for $80 a night.
Oh my gosh.
It was just super great exchange rate for us. And but just spectacular beauty. And I want to go back and do all the coffee plantations too and go check that out.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Take the tour.
Okay, so for my pro tech tip, I'm actually going very techie this time. Not not that this isn't complete nerd info, but it pretty much is. I just put out a blog post on the differences between USB-C, which most new laptops and a lot of devices have, and Thunderbolt 3, which all Macs have, and it's really the only port available on it. Like, we have a newer MacBook Pro, and it has four Thunderbolt 3. See, I almost said the wrong thing there. Has four Thunderbolt 3 ports, and that's it. I mean, that, and one single audio port, which I'm sure will go away at some point. So if you want to read a lot of info on these two names and find out exactly what it is, check out this week's blog post. Actually, I take that back. Today's Tuesday. It's going to go out tomorrow. It's tomorrow's blog post. So January. Hold on. Now I got to actually be authentic here. We're going to record. So tomorrow's blog post, January 22nd, I've got a full breakdown. One of the reasons I did it is, it's very confusing. I'll give you a really quick recap. And if you got our Christmas card from TLC Creative, we gave a little adapter to like 200 people. And if you didn't get one, I'm sorry. I only ordered 200. And then Lori told me our mailing list is bigger. So, yes.
Troy, I got one and it must be really, really small because there was nothing
what?
In there.
Oh no!
I got the little card and it was
really small.
It is an awesome one.
I had Jeff get
really. No, I'm actually just concerned they would get lost in the mail, like fall. You know, like the envelope would rip. Okay, beside that, I will make sure you're taken care of. It's very cool. Okay, so here's a quick recap. USB-C and Thunderbolt, they use the same connector, so they look the same. It's part of the reasons there's lots of confusion. It breaks down to this: Thunderbolt 3 is more powerful than USB-C. As example, USB-C can transfer data at 10 gigabits per second, which is crazy fast. Thunderbolt 3 can transfer, not only can it transfer data, but can also do full video signal at 40 gigabits. So it's four times faster as far as it is. Last, all USB-C devices, they will work in a Thunderbolt 3 connector, but not all Thunderbolt 3 devices will work if they're plugged into a USB-C connector. So there's a lot of technical confusion around them. I'm putting out a blog post, and it's actually going to be a LinkedIn article that I'll put out with a little more details. I just find it incredibly confusing, and it all really stemmed from two things. One, we gave a Christmas gift away, and a lot of people have kind of gotten back to me and said, okay, what's the difference, or does this work on my computer? And two, we have docking stations now that are Thunderbolt or USB-C based, and there's a difference in what they can perform. So, okay, Nolan, you're up.
Well, as someone who just purchased a new iMac with Thunderbolt connectors, thank you for that, Troy. My pro tip is an Apple tip, and it's their kind of newish, I guess, enhanced AppleCare for the iPhone. We just bought two new iPhones, my wife and I, and I always purchase AppleCare for everything that you can. It's one of the best deals around, including the phones. But they have a new, an enhanced AppleCare for the iPhones that for an extra $100 on top of I think it might be $200 or something. So for an extra $100, AppleCare Plus gets you the normal hardware protection plus theft and loss protection. So for an extra $100, for 2 years, you get theft and loss protection. And what they told me was essentially is if you lose your phone, if it gets stolen, either way, you just, as long as you have this thing, we'll give you a new phone, basically no questions asked. And they said you get one a year. So if you could lose your phone twice over the course of 2 years, and they'll just give you brand new phones. That's the way it was described to me. And that's it. So I think that's a pretty good deal for an extra $100. So if you're prone to losing things, consider it.
So thank you, everyone. This is Troy from TLC Creative Services, a professional design studio. Check us out at tlccreative.com, the PowerPoint blog, which I mentioned in the tech tips, thepowerpointblog.com, and just look forward to hearing from you.
This is Nolan from Nolan Hames Creative. Check out my blog, presentyourstory.com, where you can get lots of free downloads and goodies. And if your organization is interested in on-site presentation or data viz training, drop me a line or learn more at nolanhamescreative.com.
This is Sandy Johnson with Presentation Whiz. You can visit my website and my blog at presentationwhiz.biz or find me at the Presentation Guild at presentationguild.org. I'm also on LinkedIn as Sandra Johnson, PowerPoint MVP, and Twitter at PPTWhiz.
Hey, thanks for having me today. So if anybody's interested in the fourth edition of my book, be sure to get the color version. It's the one with the blue color and the slides on it. So check that out. And if you want to keep in contact, I'd love to start the conversation or continue it. Just go to my website, cliffatkinson.com. And the website for the book is beyondbulletpoints.com. Thanks again for having me. It's been a real pleasure. So excited to talk to you guys. And hopefully I might get invited back. I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Oh, you will be. Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you for joining us for another great presentation design conversation. Episode show notes are available on your favorite podcast software or at the Presentation Podcast website, www.thepresentationpodcast.com. The Presentation Podcast is produced by TLC Creative Services Incorporated. You can contact us with episode suggestions, questions for the hosts, or comments through the podcast website. And please share with others. Mention us, leave a review, and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. New episodes release on the first and third Tuesday of each month.